Motor Talk with Toby Hagen.
Hi, Toby. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Thank you, Suzanne. Hello.
Hello.
I hope I don't have to talk about Pavlovas.
Well, I'm not sure what we can find that Pavs and cars have in common.
Anyway, not much.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about the official sales figures. What's going on in the latest reports?
Yeah, look, the December sales figures, as you touched on, came out earlier this year. And look, the lowest vehicle sales since 2011. So a very tough, it's actually been a tough 2022 months for the industry generally. So the market overall up, down almost 8%, and December down 3.8%. So I think the positive to take out of that is that we're probably getting somewhere towards the bottom of where the market's been over the last sort of year and a half, something like that. So the slide hasn't been quite as severe as it has been in the months earlier in 2019. But that one you mentioned about the SUVs, the first drop since 2009 for SUV sales, which is enormous. I mean, these things have been booming for 20-odd years now in terms of the growth of the sales and the spread of the market going from, I guess, hardcore off-roaders, which is what it was 20, 25 years ago, to now obviously very family-friendly and in many cases only two-wheel drive vehicles. So to see that market drop off, I guess, suggests that maybe we're hitting the limit a little bit with those as well. But SUV market share still grew a little bit. So it's now 45% of the market. Now compare that with your regular passenger cars and they're at 30% of the market. Utes, those things that just seem to keep on growing, they've had another year of growth, so they now make up 19% of overall sales. So almost one in five new vehicles sold is a ute, which is just incredible when you think about what they're used for.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Toyota was the top seller?
Yeah, Toyota the top seller again. Interestingly, though, Toyota sales were down slightly, about 5%. But I guess you look at market share, Toyota's market share actually increased to the point where they actually sold more cars than second place and third place combined, which is Mazda and Hyundai. So Toyota's certainly very dominant out the front there. The Hilux was the top-selling vehicle, 47,000 of them sold throughout 2019, and then it went down to the Ford Ranger, another ute, so utes in the first two positions, and then Toyota Corolla, Hyundai i30, and Mitsubishi Triton. So a lot of utes and a lot of small cars still going strongly.
Mm-hmm. All right, and sales of luxury cars were down a bit too, I see.
Yeah, that's right, absolutely. So luxury cars down about 4%. So again, market share of luxury cars reasonably strong, but the market there down a bit. BMW, Mercedes-Benz, absolutely dominant. They actually make up about half of all luxury vehicle sales. So to put that in perspective, there's about 20-odd brands that classify as luxury brands. So the remaining 18 of them are scrabbling over that 50% of the market.
What do you have to do to classify as a luxury brand?
Oh, it's a bit tricky, that. So this is actually me dicing the figures and trying to determine what's a luxury brand. But it is tricky. So you look at brands like, I mean, there's obviously some very obvious ones, Bentley and Rolls-Royce and Ferrari and so on, pretty clearly tick the box. But then you get down to things like Mini and you sort of think, well, okay, it's not really a luxury brand, but it's also, they've got a fairly big price premium on their cars. So this, I guess, sort of in the prestige end of the market. Mm. You've then got some other brands that play a little bit in both, stuff like Land Rover, for example, which, you know, they do a lot of very luxurious cars, Range Rovers and so on, but they've also got some more mainstream and more affordable models. So there's no clear way of saying that is definitely a luxury brand and that one's definitely not with some of them. But I, as I said, I've gone through and tried to trawl the ones that I think are luxury brands. And yeah, you see that there's definitely over the last sort of 10 odd years, there's been a trend upwards of luxury brands. But in the last 3 years, it's actually come off a little bit. So so yeah, but they do make up luxury. Those luxury brands do make up a little bit over 10% of the market. So it's we certainly like a luxury car.
Yeah. Diesel powered car sales, those are down.
Yeah, absolutely. So we bought fewer diesel cars than we have since 2015. So when I say cars here, we're not talking SUVs and utes. So they are still extremely strong in the diesel end of the market. So this is the passenger cars, your hatchbacks and wagons and sedans. So that market has really come off enormously. And it's to some extent, I mean, you touched on it earlier with hybrid vehicles going to record sales. To some extent, it's been replaced a bit by that. So we're seeing big advances in petrol technology, and hybrid is now getting to the point where it is a lot more affordable. So it's starting to make sense for a lot more people. So hybrid sales, as you said, hit a record year. The sales almost doubled compared with 2018. But to put it in perspective, they still make up just 2.9% of the market. So it's still a very, very small percentage of the market. And you keep in mind that hybrids have been on sale now in Australia for a little bit over 20 years. So it's taken that long to get up to 2.9% of the market.
Do you think that growth is going to sort of start growing exponentially, or it's going to take longer to in smaller increments?
No, I think it will. We are now hitting a tipping point where it's starting to make a lot more sense for more people, and more manufacturers are bringing them in, and the price premium, I mean, you go back that 20-odd years, the price premium on a hybrid was $10,000 to $15,000. Nowadays, it's as little as $1,500 to get into a hybrid. So that payoff in fuel savings is so much shorter than it ever has been before. So people can theoretically pay them off in some cases in 2 or 3 years, which obviously makes more sense.
Look, while we're talking hybrids, we might mention that Toyota is stepping away from claims that it's going to have a hybrid on every model by 2025.
Well, an electric, yeah. So Toyota's been talking about doing electrified versions of all their cars by 2025. And as you said, a hybrid vehicle in every one by 2025. Now, the one car that's going to catch them out is the Supra, which is their sports car. This is sort of the $85,000 plus sports car, BMW engine and everything underneath it. And it's actually built in the same factory as the BMW Z4, that is. But they have come out and said, well, we're not actually going to do a hybrid version of that. But they do admit that that car will continue to be sold beyond 2025. So a little bit of a step back there from their position of saying everything will have an electrified version. But look, they are, I guess, the ones leading this push towards hybrid in particular. Mm-hmm. We've seen a lot of new hybrids come out from Toyota, and they're talking pretty bold numbers over the next year or two in terms of percentage of their vehicle sales. Sort of, I think it's up around 30-odd percent, 30-40% of their vehicles eventually, within the next few years, they want to be hybrid. So it's certainly a big step up.
Mm-hmm. Before we get to the calls, we might just mention it's that time of year when you can get some really good deals.
You can, yeah. Look, obviously the run-out specials, the 2019 models that now you start seeing, obviously hitting the dealerships, and in some cases you get some pretty decent discounts on there. The big question is, how much can you save? And I'm sure there's lots of people out there shopping at the moment thinking, well, okay, I'm going to get a 2019 model, therefore I expect it to be a lot cheaper. In some cases that is right. You will potentially get it a fair bit cheaper. But it all comes down to supply and demand. I mean, ultimately, the car companies that have done a good job running out their models by the end of last year or very early this year, they're not going to be giving big discounts. Mm. They may not have cars to give big discounts on. But the other ones that have got paddocks full of cars that they're trying to get rid of, that's where you're going to get the discounts.
So, who are they, Toby? Do you know which ones?
We'll do some investigation on that over the next few weeks. And that'll become clearer over the next few weeks. You'll start to see the pencils getting sharpened and those sorts of things. There's another thing to be aware of, though, with these 2019 models is there are two build or plates that you get on a car that have a date stamped on them. One of them is the build plate, fairly obvious. It's the month the car came off the production line, and these days, obviously, all cars in Australia are imported. So typically, that build plate can be 2, 3, 4 months before what's called the compliance plate. Now, the compliance plate is when the car docks in Australia and is authorised for sale in the country. So it gets a compliance plate, put on it in Australia. And as I said, that date can be 2, 3, 4 months behind the compliance, the build date. So it's worth keeping that in mind for a few reasons. What we're going to start to see over the next few weeks, and there'll certainly be some in dealerships now, are cars that will have a compliance plate of 2020, but obviously they won't have been built in 2020. Mm. There'll be 2019 cars. Now, the dealer can legally advertise that as a 2020 car. When you sell it, you can sell it as a 2020 car. But if you go to trade it in at a dealership, they will more than likely value it as a 2019 car and try and make it seem like it's a year older. So it's worth keeping that in mind when it does come time to sell that car, that it may, in the industry's eyes, be seen as a year older. And obviously, age on a car is not a good thing.
Is there any point in having an argument with the dealership at that point?
Look, you can certainly point it out and say to them, because they'll turn around straight away and sell it as a 2020 model. Yeah. This is in 3 or 4 years. You can certainly point it out. They're obviously pretty good at negotiating. chatting. They know the buttons to press. But and look, there are some people as well who will say, I want a 2020 build car. They want the car to have come off the production line in 2020. So, and that's on the private market and so on. So look, absolutely, you can point it out to them and say, look, hang on, the car is technically a 2020 model. It's got a compliance plate of 2020. But yeah, as I said, they'll try and push every button they can and pull every lever to make sure that they're paying a little bit less for your car.
Of course. All right, we've got Chris on the line up first. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
What's your question, Chris?
Oh, hi, Toby. Yeah, I'm in the market to buy a small SUV, and I was wondering what your view of that sector is, including things like the VW T-Roc, the new Q3 series, the Skoda Kami Q, I think it is, and the Seltos, maybe. Is there a standout amongst any of the current ones or the new ones coming into the country?
The Skoda, you're talking about the Karoq?
No, there's a new one called the Kamiq.
Oh, okay, the Kamiq. Yeah.
And it's a smaller one.
Okay, yes, I don't know about that one. I also haven't driven the Volkswagen T-Roc or T-Cross, the two new models that are arriving shortly, other than obviously what I've seen and read overseas. But those two obviously are very close to arriving. So in terms of that small SUV segment, pretty big variation of vehicles there. And you touched on the Q3, the Audi Q3 you're talking about, yeah?
Yeah, the new 35, 45, 55, I think it is.
Yeah, the TFSI ones. So that would probably be, out of all those ones you mentioned, that would actually be the first one I'd wipe off the list. It's a good car, but it's also got a big price premium on it for what it is. And when you start looking at, so underneath, that car will share some components and engines and so on with that Volkswagen, with the Volkswagens coming out, all part of the same group. So you're going to find some similar components and things on there that suddenly you start to say, well, okay, it doesn't quite make as much sense. So as I said, I'd probably I'd probably cross that one off the list first. In terms of the rest in that in the small SUV segment, things like there's some old stalwarts in there that are pretty good. Mazda CX-3, for example, although it's very small in the back seat, very small in the boot. The Kia Seltos you mentioned is actually a surprisingly good little car. It's very spacious by small SUV standards, which obviously appeals to a lot of people. The little turbocharged engine in it is a very strong engine, and it gets things like a 7-year warranty. So it is a very strong car in terms of what it does. Suzuki Vitara is a bit of a dark horse, and the other one to stick on the list is Toyota CHR. It's also extremely good buying. They've just bought out a hybrid version of that CHR. It is actually pretty expensive, the hybrid, but the non-hybrid one's still a good car as well. The little 1.2-litre turbo is a strong engine and does a good job for what it is, for a city-sized SUV. So yeah, they're probably the standouts in that segment.
Mm. All right, Chris. All right. Thanks a lot, Chris. I'll take one from the SMS. Jerry and Engadine, what do you think about the MG SUV?
Look, MG generally is selling these days very much on price. So whereas I guess people think MG and they think, you know, little sports cars that maybe aren't as reliable as some people would hope they are. But the new MG is very different. So that little ZS SUV, I haven't driven an MG now for some time, probably 18 months, something like that. When I drove the last one, it was surprising in terms of a Chinese-made car. The obviously some Chinese cars have had some quality issues and so on. This one comes purely out of China. It's a reasonable car, but it's one of those ones that you can see that they've cut some corners in it. So things like some of the fit and finish areas of that car I drove a while ago, there were some issues. There were certainly some safety oversights. I know they've addressed them on some of their models. I'm not exactly sure what they've done with the ZS. But from a safety perspective, they did have some issues there. But yeah, so look, it's value buying. It's probably not, I wouldn't be sticking it at the top of the list in that small SUV segment. I think there's some better buys out there.
All right. I have to turn the microphone on if I want to talk to Helen, hello.
Hello, it's Russell.
Oh, Russell.
Hi. In for Helen, my wife. Look, good evening, Toby. We're looking at the Nissan Qashqai and the Seltos, but they've both got CVTs we're not familiar with. So just seeing if you might have known which might be the better model or better car for the CVT. Thanks very much.
So CVTs will fill everyone in on what they are, continuously variable transmission. So instead of your fixed gear ratios that you have in a regular automatic, they have an infinite number of ratios, and the car adjusts to how you're driving. So A lot of CVTs can feel a bit slushy. They can feel like, particularly when you're taking off, they don't necessarily have that crispness when you first hit the throttle. So it feels almost a bit like a slipping clutch. It doesn't necessarily pick up the way a lot of people would expect. Some of them aren't nearly as good as other ones. And things like, well, if you went back years ago, some of the Nissans were decent but not great. Some of the Hondas were pretty average. These days, Honda's lifted its game enormously. Toyota, I think, does some of the better ones. And they do an interesting take on it. They've got a regular first gear matched to a CVT as well with some of their cars. Out of those two you mentioned, they both, from my memory, they do a reasonable job. I think the Kia is probably a fraction ahead. And as an overall package, I'd put the Kia a fraction ahead of the Qashqai as well. The Qashqai's advantage is these days value. They certainly get them out the door at a reasonable price, but that Seltos is also exceptional value and actually surprisingly good car to drive as well.
Okay, you know much about the new model that might be coming out, the Qashqai at all? Thanks very much.
The Nissan Qashqai?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. So the
one due in another month or anything like that.
Oh, right, okay, an update. Yeah, I don't know much about the update one, no, unfortunately. But look, it's I would imagine it's the usual minor facelift that they do. So they'll tweak a few things, put a few extra features in it. It's not going to be a wholesale change.
Look, thank you very much for that, Toby. I think it's cool. Been the main thing with CVT, the difference. That was the main thing.
All right. Thanks a lot, Russell. All right. Now, Toby, tell us about Ford and its plans for the Raptor.
Ford Raptor. Well, this is an interesting one. So it's I did a story for Wheels magazine earlier this year that touched on some changes that look like they'll be coming to the Raptor, and that is that it's looking like getting a V8 engine as an option. So they're looking to do a high-performance version. To some people, they might think, wow, how come it's taken this long to get here? When you look at, I guess, the history of Ford and Holden in Australia, and they really built a lot of their reputations on high-performance V8s and, in a lot of ways, V8 utes. Admittedly, very different utes to what the Raptor is and the Ranger Raptor is, but there were a lot of, in some ways, they were Australia's sports cars. They were the cars that Australians loved to buy and sold at times in very big numbers. So, yeah, the rumour is they're doing a V8 version of the Raptor, which I think will be, it'll be pretty cool if they do it. They'll certainly get, it's looking like getting the 5-litre V8 out of the Mustang, so that makes about 339 kilowatts, so certainly a massive step up from where they are now in terms of performance, more than double the power, so it's, going to be a good one. And interestingly how they're going to do it too, they're talking about, so the cars will still come in from Thailand where mm-hmm. they're produced, they'll come in as regular Ranger Raptors with diesel engines, but they're actually going to do a whole lot of local engineering in Australia. So they'll take the engines out, they'll then re-engineer them with the V8 engines in them, and they'll sell them as, obviously, high-performance models, which then begs the question of what do you do with all these old 2-litre, 4-cylinder diesel engines? But no doubt they'll find it.
Does that mean that Ford's still got engineering workshops here then? Or?
No, so this is... Ford and General Motors, uh-huh. Holden and Toyota all have engineering and design workshops in Australia, but this won't be done by the Ford Engineering Workshop. It's actually going to be done by... It looks like one of these external engineering places. So at the moment, you've got things like Herod down in Melbourne. You've got Premcar and HSV does a bunch of engineering as well in Australia. So this is where they will engineer changes and tweaks to a car up to manufacturer standard, the original manufacturer standard, but then and then it will be sold in a regular dealership, a Ford dealership with a Ford warranty. It'll be all up to regular standard. So yeah, it's actually Australia's turning into, well, it's still got a very strong engineering side going on, and it seems to be picking up a little bit at the moment. So yeah, a fair bit of work going on.
All right, now speaking of Ford, a 1968 Ford Mustang, which was not a very good condition, just sold at auction for almost $5 million. Why?
Yeah, this was over in the States. So $3.4 million, almost $5 million Aussie dollars. It's a car with serious pedigree, Suzanne. So this is the one of the two cars that was used in the Steve McQueen movie Bullet. So it was it was in that very famous scene where the car was obviously jumping through off all the roads in San Francisco. The car had been sort of effectively lost for decades. People didn't quite know where it was, and it appeared at a motor show in 2018. So all of a sudden, Ford did a limited edition version of the modern Mustang that they called the Mustang Bullet, And alongside it, at the motor show reveal, arrived the one of the original movie cars. Was driven out on the stage, and the car is completely unrestored. So it's got dings, it's got rust. It doesn't look a whole lot. It doesn't look like anything. And I mean, normally it'd sell for a couple hundred dollars, and all of a sudden it got almost $5 million.
So where had it been all that time?
Well, it was originally from the movie. It was bought straight after the movie, pretty much, by an employee of the theatre company Warner Brothers that did the movie. Mm-hmm. He held on to it for a few years, and then he sold it to another guy called Robert Keenan, who's since passed away. But he and his wife often used it as a daily driver. It then sat in a garage or a shed for years and basically was unloved. And then eventually it was handed back, and I think bought out of retirement, and people said, this is one of the cars. And it was verified as one of the cars, and off it went. So, yeah, an amazing story. And as I said, someone's come out and said, we'll pay $5 million for that.
Deep pockets.
Not a bad payday.
Johnny Texter says, blimey, why don't they just call the V8 Ranger the Aggressor?
Yeah. Yeah, they've all got to have macho names, haven't they, these cars?
Now, speaking of mentioning Ford and Holden, strange enough, Toby, I've just started watching this TV show. It's called Mindhunter. The main character is called Ford Holden.
Holden Ford. His name's Holden Ford.
I can't help but laugh every time, time he comes up.
I'm doing exactly the same. I've started watching it I'm going, hang on. Holden Ford. And they actually make a reference about the 8th or 9th episode. They make a reference to, it's an Australian joke or something like that, his name. They actually say, his name's an Australian
because
joke. So.
How can no one even be laughing or smirking? Yeah, but my husband was saying, the brand name Holden isn't actually well-known in the States at all. Is that right?
Some car enthusiasts probably would be, but no, I wouldn't have thought so. It's Holden's pretty much it's an Australian and New Zealand brand. So,
all right, well, I'm not up to episode 8 or 9 yet, so I'll look forward to that.
Indeed.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Hello, Alex.
Oh, g'day, Toby. Had a test drive of a WRX STI a couple of weeks ago and really enjoyed it. Just wondering whether there's anything similar and your opinion on the STI.
You mean other, like a rival that would be similar to
it? Yeah, a rival. That's right, yeah.
You got heaps of options in that market. I guess the one thing that the WRX does well is, well, I guess they're a little bit unique in that they do a sedan, whereas most of them are the hot hatches in that end of the market. So I guess you go to one of the more obvious, the Volkswagen Golf GTI, and probably the one that's, I guess, closest to it in terms of performance and having that all-wheel drive is the Volkswagen Golf R. So it just steps it up a little bit in terms of what it does. Definitely worth having a drive of that in terms of the outright performance. It's probably a little bit more livable day-to-day than a WRX, a fraction, but the WRX is still a pretty solid thing. One of the interesting things with the current WRX is it's obviously based on the previous generation Subaru Impreza, and whereas it used to be called the Subaru Impreza WRX, they've dropped the Impreza reference and now simply refer to it as the WRX. So it's there's a new model due. We don't know quite when. I'm not expecting it this year, but I would have thought in the next 18 months or 2 years there'll be a new model coming out. So keep an eye out for that as well. Other cars to look at, I mean, look, you know, anything like a things like a Hyundai i30, the N version of that, which is a very high performance vehicle, very good fun car, particularly on a racetrack if you can deal with that or want to, I guess, thrash your car around a track. Not quite as outright quick as an STI, but certainly a good fun thing. And then you got everything down to Renault Megane RSs and so on. But the closest, I guess, would be that. Golf R, the Volkswagen Golf R. But you're also, interestingly, starting to get into territory there with things like BMW 1 Series and Audi A3s, where you can start to get a fair bit of performance in some of the lower versions or the more sporty versions of those as well. So worth keeping an eye out. But definitely have a look at a Volkswagen Golf R.
All right, thanks very much. Yeah.
Thanks, Alex. On the SMS, someone wants to know about the Lamborghini SUV.
Oh, the Urus.
Urus.
Spelt U-R-U-S, but they don't like saying Urus. They like saying Urus. It shares a lot of its components and its basic architecture with a lot of other Volkswagen Group SUVs. So Volkswagen Touareg, Audi Q7, Porsche Cayenne, Bentley Bentayga, and that Lamborghini are all built on the same architecture. So they all share the same basic platform underneath them. The Lamborghini obviously has a bit more wow factor, so it's got a heck of a lot of performance. It is, I'm trying to think of any other SUV that accelerates like it. It's certainly extremely brisk off the line, and it makes some good noises, albeit some of them a little bit fake in terms of how they do it. But look, very strong twin turbo V8, got that Lamborghini shock factor. Is it worth twice as much as something like a Porsche Cayenne? Probably not. It's a little bit of the law of diminishing returns, but it is a very quick car and it certainly stands out on the road. But yeah, I mean, I would also say, as I said, look at some of those other ones and see what's available there. But yeah, the Lambo certainly surprised me. I got in it thinking, you know, this will be a brisk car. I didn't think it'd be quite as quick as it was. So it's a pretty cool thing. It's also the most affordable Lamborghini on the market, and you get more doors, more space, and more features than any of the other ones. So it's, if you look at it that way, it's a bargain.
Now, Toby, Oslo in Norway has made headlines for having a single fatality in 2019.
That's right. Yeah, it's I saw a story the other day, and it's raving about how they've only had a single fatality. But you start delving into the story and looking at a few more of the statistics, and it's maybe not quite as radical as it sounds. Because for starters, there's only 650,000 people living in in Oslo, so that's sort of similar to the Gold Coast, something like that. Maybe a few more than Newcastle. So a much smaller population than somewhere like Sydney or Melbourne. And you then start looking at the average metropolitan road fatality rate, and it was 1.9 per 100,000 versus, that's in Australia, versus Norway's 2.07 per 100,000 people. So our rate of fatalities per 100,000 people was actually slightly lower once you took all those factors into consideration. But yeah, I mean, look, there's lots of parts of the world that do road safety quite differently to Australia, and they're obviously kicking some goals on their own targets. So, yeah.
Goodness me, Toby. I mentioned we had a couple of lines free and got the whole boards just lit up now. Folks, you should have got in early, though. David is up next. Hello.
Hello, Suzanne and Toby. Good evening.
Hi.
I live in rural Australia. I'm looking for a sedan to purchase that's got a full-size spare wheel and can carry a decent-sized bull bar on the front.
Wow. And you definitely want a sedan?
Preferably, yes.
Yeah, wow. Look, the most obvious, straight off the bat, and it may not have... It's got a V6 engine, but the most obvious, I think, for that sort of part of the world would be a Toyota Camry. And I don't think they have... Well, they don't have a full-size spare on every single model, but they do have a full-size spare available on some models. Hyundai is also pretty big with putting full-size spare tyres in, so something like a Hyundai Sonata could work for that as well. They've got a 2-litre turbo, which is quite a strong engine, be good for country touring and so on. You're ruling out things like Mazda 6s. I don't think they have full-size spares, and Volkswagen Passats, I think, also have space-saver spares as well. But for my money, for, I guess, value and suitability to that sort of thing, something like a Camry, I think, would do quite a nice job.
Well, yes, we currently own a Camry and have been very pleased with that, but with the wild animal population, the necessity of a bull bar is fairly forefront in our mind.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge, obviously, with getting a bull bar for a vehicle like that is the manufacturers themselves won't offer them because there's just not the demand for them. They obviously tend to push people towards the four-wheel drive side of the equation. But there'll be some sort of aftermarket supplier that will do it. Be aware, though, that whenever you're doing that sort of thing, putting a bull bar on a car, it can have pretty serious implications with how the airbags and so on go off. And I've spoken to a few engineers about this and the challenges that are involved, and you'll see a lot of the aftermarket bull bar suppliers will talk about how they've done all the engineering work and so on. I've spoken to engineers at car companies who say we don't know how they could possibly do the level of engineering and all the permutations that you need to put into a computer to figure out how it's going to explode properly. So they say there's a lot more to it. Probably because they're trying to sell their ones that they've spent a lot of work engineering, but at the same time, it's worth keeping that in mind that it can impact airbag firing and so on. And there were certainly a lot of issues early on in the life of airbags. These days, a lot more work's been done on a lot more understanding of it, but it's worth keeping it in mind.
Good. Thanks very much, David.
All right. Thanks, David. Now, Toby, let's have a little look about emission standards, because the industry is really in need of some clarity and planning around what emission standards are going to be in Australia in the future.
Oh, absolutely. This has been going on for years and years and years, Suzanne, to the point where the current is just starting to scream out for it and saying to the government, give us some clarity about where we're going, because they just don't know at the moment. Nothing's been done for 4 or 5 years to try and say, well, here is how we're going to start bringing ourselves up to the rest of the world. Australia runs years behind places like Europe in terms of its emissions standards, and we're no closer to learning when any of that is going to change. And one of the big issues we've got is the quality of our petrol. Our diesel is okay, but our petrol has quite high sulphur contents on some grades of petrol in Australia, to the point where some car makers are now saying, well, we can't actually sell the latest version of our engines because there's potential damage there to some of the emissions hardware on the car.
Really? So, why do we have such bad quality petrol?
Cheaper is the short story. Right. So to upgrade.
So we're just importing the cheap stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And also the refineries. The refineries in Australia. Yeah, the refineries in Australia also don't can't do the lower sulphur. So I think it's around 10 parts per million of sulphur is what the European standards are at. In Australia, we can have petrol that's up to 150 parts per million. So I remember chatting to someone from Volkswagen who said they've done the analysis of it. And one of the issues are these things called particulate filters, which are common in diesel cars now. They're starting to come out in petrol cars. So petrol particulate filter. And that's the thing that you can end up damaging. Too much sulfur will damage those. And Volkswagen says that I think they said 1 to 2 tanks is enough to ruin that particulate filter. And then it's thousands of dollars to repair it. So if they let these cars out onto the market, all of a sudden they're going to have cars coming back in with faults to their particulate filters. And as I said, they say they can't offer warranty on them, which is why they're not selling them here at the moment. They've decided not to bring those cars in. So huge issues there in terms of the standards. But yeah, I mean, look, obviously the government's got some bigger issues at the moment, but there's...
You're saying it's been going for 4 or 5 years. Why are there no answers?
Well, I think a lot of it got caught up in I guess, the turmoil within politics generally, changing prime ministers so often and maybe bigger things on their mind, bigger things to focus on. I mean, I've spoken to some people in the industry who've said they think they're very close to coming up with a response, but this was 12 or 18 months ago, and they were saying, oh, we think in the next month or two something might get announced. Never happened. So as I said, the car industry needs clarity. One thing with car makers that I think some politicians don't understand is these guys are planning 5 and 10 years out. They're trying to work out where their strategy is going and where their manufacturing and resources and engineering resources and so on are going. So they can't just say, okay, next year or in 2 years' time, you suddenly have to adhere to these standards. Mm. They will not have the
much longer
the
procedures lead time
in place. Yeah. And look, they're bringing cars to market. The average lifespan of a car is typically 6 or 7 years. Some of them will go for 10 or 12 years. So when they're bringing those cars to market, they have to make sure that they can, endure and make them the money they need to make. So, yeah.
Interesting. All right, Julie is on the line. Hello, Julie.
Oh, hello, Suzanne. Hello, Toby. Look, I'm looking at buying a medium-sized hatch, and I'm tossing up between a VW Golf and a Peugeot. I think it's a 208 in that size.
308, it'll be.
308, sorry, yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Has either of those got a full-size spare?
I don't think so, no. So if you had a chance, it'd be the Golf, but I don't think it does. Full-size spare tyres are very rare these days. Unless you're buying off-road vehicles, four-wheel drives and utes and so on, they pretty much have them on everything. But on your regular passenger cars, they tend not to have them for two reasons. One, space, and the other one is, three reasons. Space, trying to reduce weight, and also trying to save money. Yeah. Probably the money one's the biggest one for a lot of the car makers out there. I don't think either of those ones do. In that market, you'd have to look at some Toyota Corollas, not all of them, and some Hyundai i30s and possibly a Kia Cerato. So,
I've had a Golf before and I really liked it. I've passed it on to my son-in-law and still going strong.
Yep.
I'd prefer to get a petrol car.
Yep.
And I don't like too much technology. I've had a 1 Series BMW and I got rid of that because it was too high tech, more than I wanted.
Well, I've got some bad news for you on that, because they're all going to have more tech than your old 1 Series. So even right. if the 1 Series was any more than 18 months or 2 years old, everything you look at now will have more technology, in particular the safety technology. So a lot of them, or almost everything these days, has things like lane departure warning. Some of them will have blind spot warning, and they'll pretty much all have automatic emergency braking, or autonomous emergency braking. So the cars can automatically apply the brakes to try and avoid a crash. So they're all going to have that sort of tech. A lot of them will have the smartphone connectivity. But look, between the Golf and the 308, I'd stick the Golf ahead, partially on resale value in terms of in 3, 4, 5 years' time when you want to sell it. I think it's going to be an easier car to sell than a Peugeot 308, and certainly history suggests that a Volkswagen will hold its value a bit better in Australia. And also keep in mind, there is an all-new Volkswagen Golf that has already been unveiled overseas, so you can look online and see some pictures of that. And that car is due in Australia, I think it's later this year, so that car's on the way into Australia as well.
Oh,
so.
Great. Thanks, Toby. All That's right. Great help. Bye-bye now.
Thanks, Julie. Peter, you've got some issues with the cruise control on the car.
Oh, yeah. G'day, Suzanne.
Hello.
Toby. I bought an Astra in the middle of the year. I'm very happy with it, but I've got a bit of a concern with the cruise control. Even on a fairly moderate sort of downslope, it'll sneak up, 5 k's or even more above the limit. So I'm just wondering, I recall my previous car, you'd only go 1 or 2 clicks over and it'd be back. But wondering what sort of limits should you have to expect on cruise control, and 2, is it something just the dealer can fix if it's something wrong?
So if there's something wrong, yes, the dealer can fix it. I tend to think on what you're talking about, there's nothing wrong as the car was engineered and sold. So there can be pretty big differences between cruise control systems. And I remember years ago doing a big country cruise in a Lexus hybrid, and I thought, oh, well, this will have pretty good cruise control. And it did all right on flat, and it did all right going down a hill sometimes. But often when I'd go up the hill, it would actually, as we crested the hill, it would put on 15 or 20 kilometres an hour, and you'd have to jump on the brakes to stop it from exceeding the limit. So there can be very big differences in how some of them work. Quite a lot of them these days will, the more advanced ones will have they'll actually brake for you. So the car will apply the brakes and it won't disconnect the cruise control. So it'll do it all and maintain its speed and do a really nice job of it. Other cars will flare and do exactly what you're talking about and jump a little bit over the limit. So I tend to think, I haven't got a whole lot of experience with the Astra doing that, but I tend to think that's what's going on there. It's just not a particularly good cruise control, and it may not be well set up for Australian roads. I mean, you think about, things like where a lot of these cars are from, in Europe, for example, where they'll stick them on fairly open and higher speed freeways where they might be doing 130, 140 kilometres an hour, and they may not be as well set up for Australian roads. So, look, you can ask the dealer and say, can they check it out? And they'll go and activate it, but I think they'll say it's probably within tolerances. So, the only solution really is to monitor it and buy a different car next time.
All right, Peter.
Give the dealer feedback as well, because that sort of stuff, if enough people say it, it does make it back to the engineering departments, and particularly with Holden with an Astra, and they're obviously trying to position themselves as the Australian car company now that they only import cars. That's pretty important to them. So with that sort of thing, they will start listening if enough people say it. So it's worth feeding it back for sure.
All right, thanks, Peter. And yet, Toby, if we all complain about having not having regular size spares, they're not going to do anything about that, are they?
Well, some of them may, but the what that'll all come down to is it'll be a product planner somewhere who'll look at it and say, okay, if we put full-size spares in, how much will it cost us and how many extra sales will we get for that? And if the answer is it'll cost X amount and that's too much and we won't actually get more sales out of it, then they won't do it. So if enough people say it, then yes, they will. But what they tend to find with that sort of thing is that not enough people will jump up and down. Look, some manufacturers, Toyota and Lexus, have done it actually, where they offer a full-size spare option, and it actually, they just raise the floor a couple of inches, the floor of the boot a couple of inches. So you lose a bit of boot space, but you can put the full-size spare in there. I don't think many people take it up, but there's the occasional person who says, yes, I must have a full-size spare. And look, I can understand it. Not so much in city areas, but certainly, you know, if you're out in the country or regularly driving in country areas, then, yeah, you want to make sure you can...
Toby, I mean, last summer I had, you know, I had a break... The tyre went in the middle of country Victoria. We had to drive an hour and a half out of our way so that we could replace the spare, which we wouldn't have had to do. It cost us hours not having that full-size spare in the car.
And the other thing with those, the Space Saver spares, is pretty much all of them, you then limit your recommended top speed, and I think legal top speed, to 80 kilometres an hour.
Exactly. So and I was holding, I had 10 cars behind me, it's 40 degrees.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a nightmare.
So all of a sudden you're having, I had one let go in, we were in up near Alice Springs and we had to drive back to Melbourne, and all of a sudden it let go, and we were back then, well, in a lot of parts of the territory, it's 130 kilometre an hour limit, and you suddenly have to doing 80 k's an hour. So
the most unpopular person on the road.
Felt like you were stopped.
Right. G'day, Ben.
Hello.
Hello. What's your question, Ben?
Hey, I was wondering, I'm in love with the C63, but what's Toby's view on the old one, the naturally aspirated one of the twin turbo?
Oh, it's a tricky one. So the naturally aspirated, the 6.2-litre V8, which I think got replaced, 4 or 5 years ago, something like that, now by the 4-litre twin-turbo V8. Look, the 4-litre ultimately has more grunt, but I think the 6.2 has a bit more character. And I think if you looked on the used car market, there'd be enough of them these days going for a reasonable price that that 6.2 starts to make a bit more sense. So, look, if it was my money, probably... tending a little bit towards the 6.2. I wouldn't be disappointed at all with the 4-litre. It is a super strong engine. It's a phenomenal engine. They've done a great job with it. But as I said, just a bit more character, a bit more rawness, a bit more of that performance, excitement and drama that I think a lot of people want in that sort of vehicle. And ultimately, you know, these days, AMGs in particular, they've worked so hard on the sound, on getting that character right, that any sort of tweak and change to that can sort of diminish it a little bit. And I reckon the old 6.2 was a really nice engine.
It's just that the interior is not the best, but...
No, so they stepped up the interiors enormously with the more recent ones. They went from those sort of tackier, quite plasticky-looking interiors up to something that's these days very high quality and classy. But there'll definitely be other downsides to going to the older model for sure. And these days, obviously, with the new ones, you're going to get more tech in terms of the safety, the active safety technology, things like smartphone connectivity. So there's a lot of other reasons to go for the 4-litre. But if you're talking purely engine, 6.2. But if there's other factors in there, then look around.
All right, thanks, Ben. Lots of SMS is coming in at the best. We've got so many people on the phones. I wouldn't send any more because we're not going to get to even a third of them, I don't think. Hello, Janet.
Yeah, hi. I've got about 20,000 and I've had a Subaru Impreza, but I've had transmission issues with it and need to get rid of it. But I need another car about that size. What would you suggest?
So you're talking secondhand or?
Yeah, well, I've only got 20,000.
Well, you're still, at that sort of money, you do have, you've got some really good options in terms of secondhand options. You can stick to some slightly safer bets. Something like a Mazda 3 would be well worth having a look at. There's some terrific ones of those, particularly in the last, well, the new model came out about a year ago. A bit under a year ago it came out. If you can get one of those for 20 grand, that would be really good buying. So the current shape car, you might struggle a little bit. They tend to hold their value pretty well. Something like a Ford Focus could be a left fielder on the budget side of the equation. Not as good a car as the Mazda, and inside it's certainly not as elegant, but it's also reasonable buying. And another one is Kia Cerato. Cerato has come a really long way, and in terms of value, you'll almost get a new one for that. You could probably get a dealer demo for that, but you'll certainly get a nice one that's a year, 18 months old, and they also come with a 7-year warranty, so you'll still have, can buy a 2-year old one and still have 5 years of factory warranty on it. So there's some options to consider.
Fabulous. Excellent. And they're all very economical?
They're all similar, I mean, it depends. So
I do about 40,000 Ks a month.
A month or a year?
A month.
40,000 a month.
I live out of town. I live a long way out of town. I've got kids that need to go to a hospital, like about 300 k's away regularly. So I'm doing huge amounts of k's.
Yeah, wow. Yes, they are. They're all going to be probably fairly similar to your Impreza, depending on the age of your Subaru.
Yep.
But they'll all be similar. Yeah, I mean, you know, you can look at things like the Toyota Corolla Hybrid, but for the big country kilometres you're talking about, you're not going to get as much of a benefit from the hybrid system as you would driving it around town. So sitting on 100 k's an hour on a country road, the hybrid's not going to give you as much of a benefit. So the other ones will be cool.
Fabulous.
Thanks, Janet.
Thank you.
I'll get one more off the SMS, which is from Michael and Kate at Mount Kohler. What does Toby think about the Subaru Forester Hybrid? I currently have the 2013 model. It's done 103,000 kilometres. I'm thinking of changing it for the hybrid.
Yeah, so this is it's not actually out yet and we haven't driven it yet, but it is, they've announced the pricing on it. So it's about a $3,000 premium over the regular Subaru Forester or a similarly specified Subaru Forester. But interestingly, it doesn't get anything like the fuel economy benefits that something like the Toyota RAV4 Hybrid gets. So they're actually saying about a 9% reduction in fuel use as the overall, the fuel figure that's got to be on the car, whereas in city driving, they're saying about a 19% reduction in fuel use. So significant, but you're probably only looking at saving a few hundred dollars a year, which and it still makes it, I guess, similar to some of the better SUVs on the market in terms of overall fuel use. So I'm not sure I'll be launching at it purely on the fuel saving aspect of it, and I'd only be doing it, as I touched on a minute ago with the other hybrids, I'd only be doing it if I was doing a lot of around town kilometres to try and get that fuel benefit. That said, as I mentioned, I haven't driven that car yet. It's a fairly mild hybrid. You're looking at a 12 kilowatt electric motor, so it's still absolutely most of the work is done by the petrol engine that's still part of the hybrid system. But sort of mild hybrid system there.
Mm. All right, hello, Ken.
Yes, hello.
Hello. Now you've got an issue with your Bluetooth.
Yes, I got a 2012 Commodore, and the Bluetooth hasn't been working properly for ages. If you ring me and I hit the button, I cut you off. The voice part says it's ringing, but it doesn't ring the person. I can bring up the phone book. It'll work. Everything comes through. I can dial out through my phone and it'll work through the speakers of the car. But I've been to two Holden dealers and none of them been able to help me. So I was wondering where I could take it to perhaps get it fixed.
Yeah, that's a tricky one because normally with electrical issues, you'd go to an automotive electrician and they could have a crack at it.
But
I'm not sure how many would be up on Bluetooth issues. Is the software on your phone up to date?
Yeah, well, like one of them said, I went to Telstra and they said the phone's quite good, nothing's wrong with the phone.
Okay, because that can sometimes be the issue too, is I know if I've been having Bluetooth issues in the car, often I've just updated the software on my phone and it suddenly fixed the issue. But look, I'm trying to think of where else you could go. I mean, other than an automotive electrician.
I'm up in northeast Victoria too, makes it hard.
Yeah, it does make it
hard. I go to Melbourne occasionally. I usually go to the northern suburbs.
Yeah. So. What I'll try and do is I'll try and look into that over the next couple of weeks and see if we can find some solutions. A, if there's a problem that's ongoing with that particular model, and B, whether I can find a solution of where to look for it. But
Well, Ken, why don't you give Suki your details and Toby might be able to check that out for you. Thanks a lot, Ken.
Thank you.
Brett, you've got a bit of a challenge for Toby, I understand.
I have, but first of all, Suzanne, if I may be so bold, based on your knowledge of cars, I'm prepared to propose marriage to you.
I'm already married. I'm sorry.
Okay. So there's a blockage in a way, but it can be dealt with.
All right. Well, we can talk about that later, Brett. Now, you've only got 3 minutes, so you better get your challenge to Toby.
Jesus Christ. Okay, sorry about that. Just the reason why you caused all Jando is because you start talking about really interesting cars instead of all that crap from, you know, Korea and parts of Germany, Japan and stuff. I know why Mercedes is selling so many cars. I had one once, a CLS 500. It was just mind-bogglingly capable across so many different things. And I had a WRX, the 2000 model, which I reckon was the absolute, it was the best of the best.
Well, that was the first of the bug-eyed one, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, no. Well, it might, okay, might have been the 99.
Yeah, the MY99 was great, I reckon.
Yeah, great. If you cut to the chase here, because the clock is ticking.
Sorry, Suzanne. Okay, so, all right. If you had, and you, this is a test for you, because you need to understand where I'm coming from. If you had to choose between a Lotus Elise and a Ford Mustang GT, which one would you go for?
It would depend what I was using it for.
Oh, don't, no, not that.
Mustang. Jesus. And I think I might have failed your test, but I only because I find the Elise, it is a terrific car on the right road and on a racetrack or something like that, but I find it fairly one-dimensional. It can be fairly tricky to live with in other situations, but terrific for what it's designed for. But the Mustang's a broader spread, and for driving around day to day and for cruising and going for a country drive and all that sort of thing, I'd stick the Mustang higher on the list. Have I failed?
You know, you actually haven't, because I'm a Ford guy from way back. And that doesn't mean I hate Holdens or anything like that. I'm not that way. I've got a daughter named Elise, and I didn't realise I named her after one of the finest handling cars ever made until several months after she was born and named. But I went to the dealer, Barbagallo in Perth. Sorry, I don't know, it's the ABC, but they just really kind of, and like, I'm not rich, I'm living in a rented house and all that, but the salesman said to me, yes, you can take the Elise out for a run, take it on your own, and whatever you do, drive it hard.
And
he's right. The harder you drive that thing, it is a wonder.
Yeah, it's a great fun little car. They're terrific cars, but as I said, a fraction one-dimensional, but great little cars.
All right, Brad, I'm going to have to let you go because the end of the hour is fast approaching. Toby, thank you so much for coming in and talking cars with us tonight.
Anytime. Thanks,
Suzanne. And you'll be back in a couple of weeks to talk to Phil. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.